everyone, and welcome to Minute 12 of Season 3 of Movie Raw Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Alan Sanders of The Wilder Ride. Welcome back to the show, Alan.
Hey, buddy. Thanks so much for having me back. It's a pleasure to be finally out of the elevator.
Yeah, that's true. I missed talking to you over the last day, so, you know, it's good to have you back. And we'll have to see, you know, what happens now that we'll step out of the elevator and see what goes on in this strange, you know, in the place where they're the only people in the building, you know. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to wait and see. But first of all, I've thought a lot since yesterday when we were talking about, you know, when does this movie take place? You know, is it taking place on Friday night, the 23rd? Is it taking place on Saturday night, the 24th? Is this Christmas Eve or not? So I did a little bit of research, and I actually had a little bit of a discussion with my good friend Jay, who was on, you know, the first week. And, you know, I told him, I said, it's for sure the 23rd. We had a little debate, and then he proved to me that it's the 24th. It is Christmas Eve, you know. So I take off my hat, you know, take off my yarmulke, my kippah, my beanie, whatever you want to call it, you know, that however you all refer to it, you know. I give Jay and you, Alan, credit for being correct. It is Christmas Eve. There are 2 points in the movie where characters specifically say that this is Christmas Eve. And, mm-hmm. you know, I don't think the characters would make that mistake if it was Friday night as opposed to Saturday night. I mean, again, it's possible what you said, that maybe this takes place in 87, but it doesn't matter. The bottom line is whether it takes place on Friday or Saturday, that doesn't make a difference. But the bottom line is it does take place on Christmas Eve. Holly mentions to Ellis in the first week that it is Christmas Eve. And later on in the movie, when we get Gail Wallins giving her news report, she says, our top story is this Christmas Eve. So mm-hmm. there you go. I have been proven wrong, which I'm happy that I was proven wrong in the third week. So, you know, we'll have time to continue with the notion. I believed up until last week, I was, when everyone can listen to my conversation with Tyler and how the two of us came to the conclusion that this was Friday night, but apparently that was wrong. Sorry, Tyler, we were both wrong. It actually is Christmas Eve. So
can I ask you a question? Cause we didn't really cover it yesterday, but I know I mentioned it because as we started the discussion, I said, I'm here to talk about my favorite Christmas film of all time.
No, let's keep that. Let's keep that for later in the week. We'll talk about that. We'll have that discussion later in the week.
Okay. All right. You know, as long as you promise to have it.
I promise.
I get in this discussion every time, either on the radio, on other podcasts, whenever this subject comes up, and I will tell you.
All right. Hold your thoughts. We will get to it. Okay. On Friday, we will talk about it. How's that? You know, even telling people, I'm teasing everybody that you have to come back on Friday if you want to hear Alan's thoughts on this subject, you know, and we'll see. Okay. We'll have a discussion about it, and we'll figure that out.
Look, right? You know what? My wife's going to actually write to you off air saying, how did you do that? How did you take Alan and not only shut him up, but get him to promise not to talk about something he wants to talk about for a few days?
Is she there?
No, she's
out. Oh, okay. She's not standing next to you saying, hearing that. Okay.
She's going to go, this is a million-dollar bestseller. How did you do that?
It's the beauty of talking about Die Hard. That's how I got you to. That's how I'm getting you to shut up about a certain thing for 4 days. How's that? Or 3 days, actually.
True, because I want to come back. So.
Yeah. And I want you back, so that's good, too. You know, as we discussed in the green room, it's not good to piss people off. You know, that's But that's a completely different discussion. Okay, so minute 12 begins with McClane taking in the party, and ends with John walking up a flight of stairs towards an Oriental man whoever's seen the movie knows that it's Takagi. So the elevator doors opened yesterday at the end of yesterday's minute, and today they continue opening. And one of the things I love about this minute, there's very little dialogue. There's very little that happens, but the one thing that we get through this entire minute is we see McClane using his detective skills to look around and take it all in. You know, mm-hmm. there's no question about it. He's looking, he steps out of the elevator. You know, we get the idea that he's the perfect cop, because he's using his intuition and suspicions, and he's trying to figure out what's going on. You know, we also don't know what's going on from, you know, if we've never seen this before. Part of the whole thing also, as we discussed, I think it was last week when he met Argo, like, what was his original plan? You know, we'll never know. Was he planning on going to the Nakatomi building anyway? Was he planning on going to the house and meeting Paulina? You know, like, what? Nobody knows what his initial plans were. He didn't know that he was going to be picked up by a limo.
That's true. That he did not know about that. I want to believe that he knew about the party, because I think we get the words, you got the invitation, but the ride was certainly a nice touch. Maybe sort of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Let's sort of make sure he gets to the building rather than leaving it down his own accord. It's a nice little thought, at least a thought exercise for us looking at the movie back, because there is a rift between him and his wife. There is.
Right. Well, that's the thing I wanted to bring up also. Right. I wanted to bring that up also. The whole idea that, okay, here's a couple that is having problems. Okay. They've been separated for 6 months. Okay. And, you know, do they want to see each other? Do they not want to see each other? Stuff like that. You know, we're not really sure how either of them feel about this.
Right.
You know, completely. We know that they both want to still give their marriage a chance, but, you know, each of them wants to do it on their own terms.
Exactly. And what I like about, to finish my thought about looking back, the idea of, and Takagi will tell us later that, you know, he says, do I have you to thank? He goes, of course. But I get the sense, maybe this also was implied from his wife saying, well, maybe we could send a driver just to make sure he knows how to get here. Not with anything else besides that, but that makes me feel just a little bit like she hinted she's willing to give it a go if he is. But right. We don't get that right off the bat, and that's never even called out. But I like to think that that's why the limo was called in the first place.
Okay, that's something that also that we'll get to a little bit tomorrow when we actually meet Takagi and start talking to him, so we can get into that then. But one of the things also, I mean, I mentioned this last week, that in the original novel, it was the company's limo that came to pick him up. You know, Argyle, or the driver, doesn't have a name in the novel, okay, but he works for the company. It's Claxon Oil, right? So he's a driver of limousines for Claxon Oil, and he's being sent to go pick up John. So there's a big difference there, as opposed to the way that it works in the movie, where Argyle just seems like a random, you know, limo driver. You know, they called up a limo company and said, all right, I want to hire a limo. You know, go over to the airport and pick up, John McClane, or J. McClane, as it says. But on the card that Argyle is holding up, it does have the symbol of Nakatomi. So maybe this is, you know, the limo company that they use all the time. So they have cards, you know, for Nakatomi. You know, I don't really know. I mean, we never get the impression that Argyle actually works for Nakatomi.
Right. I don't think so. And I think you're right. It feels more like it may be they may use the same limo service repeatedly for VIPs.
Right. But and they probably have cards already that, you know, have the symbol of Nakatomi. They're just write the name on there and have your driver go over and hold it up, you know, that type of thing.
Or for, you know, while we're playing What If, it could be where they show up at the lobby and they say, okay, where's the, who are we picking up today? Here's the card for you to take to the airport, whatever it is. But yeah,
right. I mean, that would be less efficient. That would be less efficient if it's a company that they're using often. You know, why have them come to the Nakatomi building and then send them wherever they need to go, as opposed to just sending them directly. But who cares?
You're imposing logic and reason in an 80s capitalist society. Come on.
Yes, yes, yes. You have to. You have to.
80s consumerism? Come on. Did you notice, at the very beginning, I totally agree with all of your assessment of he's very much doing a great job without overselling it of looking around. Like he is playing the detective. But did you note when the doors open that they must have set dressed the lobby of the where the elevators are with all the tables, because you can see the alternate elevators across the way?
Yes. Yes, I did notice that. But there's nothing wrong with that, you know, so you see the other elevators.
No, I just think it's interesting that the party itself, most businesses, elevator is sort of isolated from where the doors are or entrances to the receptionist or where the rest of the business is. This looks like they've decided to spill entirely into even that foyer or that standing area for all of the elevators, which I never really noticed until we slowed it down 1 minute at a time.
Right. Okay. There is something to that. So he's looking around. A waiter passes him by, and he takes a drink from the waiter's tray, which we don't see yet what type of drink it is. He has this you know, it's not like a tall champagne glass or anything like that. It looks like a smaller, you know, paper cup, plastic cup type of drink. You know, we're not really sure at this point. We'll get to it a little bit later in the minute where we actually see it. And
yeah, I think it's plastic, like clear plastic cup.
Yeah, exactly. A clear plastic cup. It could be glass. You never know. It depends. Again, you go back to your consumerism. You know, anything's possible. True. No, I don't think it's glass. I think it is plastic.
And you're right. It's not champagne. I got the sense of more of a holiday, maybe a punch or a cocktail.
Right. We won't know from the movie, but maybe the script will tell us. We'll have to wait and see. There you go. Another teaser. I love teasing you and everyone else. And then, like, we get a shot of all of these 80s executives. You know, and you mentioned it a little bit yesterday, the way that everyone looks so 80s here. You know, the hair, the clothes. You know, we get like a pan of a lot of these people. And it's just funny looking at some of them. I mean, some of them seem like stereotypes from the 80s and these type of things. You have like the tipsy girl who's trying to get her boyfriend or whoever, you know, drunk also. You know, like she's giggling and trying to actually get him to drink something, you know, whatever it is. And then we have like an executive that starts laughing and he's cleaning his mouth with a handkerchief type of thing. Who knows what he just was eating or whatever. You know, like everyone is in their conversations, you know, which what's funny is that theoretically all these people work in Nakatomi. They all know each other. You know, so here it's just okay. You know, it's Saturday night. Let's let everyone, you know, for lack of a better term, let their hair down and have fun at this Christmas party that we're throwing.
Yeah, while you mentioned hair down, you can notice part of the 80s. Look at all of the teased and hairsprayed hair for every one of the ladies. Even if they've got shorter hair, it's poofed, it's teased. It's the whole, like my wife used to say, with wings on the side where you would pull your hair out and put a bunch of aerosol and then dry it to keep it, you know, stiff and as fat and as fluffy as you could do it. And if you notice, a lot of
I never had that problem.
a lot of the women, in fact, almost everyone I see as we go through, if you want to slow it frame by frame, whether it's a dress, a jacket, whatever it is, massive shoulder pads.
Yes. Yeah. You can definitely see that the way that they're all dressed there. But I love the way that they give us this panoramic view of everything here, which I think on the one hand, it's, you know, letting McClane see what's going on. But on the other hand, it's showing us what's here, you know, on numerous levels. First of all, to give us the layout for later on as to, you know, how things here are going to play into the story itself. You know, you have like this waterfall in the middle of the room, which is gorgeous, but I don't think it's really effective to have in an office building.
Except for maybe if this is an executive suite and you want to create that ambiance, especially if you're entertaining guests, let's face it, it's impression and business is an important thing. And a lot of times that's why you'll have artwork or you'll have something like some kind of a display of ostentatiousness to let clients go, oh, wow, this company's got a lot of money. Maybe we want to do business with this company. So I don't imagine you see this on every floor. I get this being more of an executive, almost an executive suite area that's being used for the party. But you're right. Having an indoor waterfall where it cascades rain, it's a beautiful shot. But, wow, that would be amazing to see on the 30th floor of any building.
Yes, for sure. I wonder if they really have that. And you didn't go up to the 30th floor when you were in the Fox building?
No, I did not. I will tell you, knowing about this movie, this was a set. But I do like the shot. I do like the camera work. The camera, and we will probably, in any minutes that I'm on, I always appreciate how much the camera helps tell the story.
Well, but the one shot. Jan de Bont. So,
yeah. Jan de Bont. Yeah.
Jan de Bont.
Which, of course, he'll go on to be his own director, but as director of photography, just the shot.
He's a much better DP than director.
I think so. The waterfall we see initially in the shot, but then we've got this nice little move where it closes in on three people. You've got the LA sunset with the purple and gold and orange colors and the rain falling in front. It's a stunning image to set up this scene of just
with the businessman with two women around him.
Yeah.
Yeah. trying to, you know, make sure he has a good Christmas Eve.
Well, he's trying to double his odds. Well, he's got the one woman is like eye level with him. Like you can tell, it looks like they're conversing. But then there's the woman who's probably, let's make up the conversation. She's up on the ledge of the windowsill, leaning against a pillar against the window, probably looking out on the skyline, just saying, just imagine what it looks like, almost like you're falling out of the building from this view.
Yeah. Well, you can just pretend you're Hans Gruber, you know, an hour and a half from now, and you'll know at that point what it's like.
Just a little bit.
Because I think this is the floor he actually falls out of. So, yeah.
Well, and I know I'm staying on this, but if anybody freezes it in this shot, it's such a well-composed scene because you've got the greenery to the left corner.
Predator.
Water cascade.
Predator. Down. This is John McTiernan's homage to Predator.
To Predator.
Because maybe this executive is meant to be a predator.
I wasn't going there. I was going more from a perspective of painting a picture where you've got open sky in the upper right corner of the frame. You've got an earthy presence in the bottom left, and then your subjects are kind of not exactly dead center, but just off in one of the quadrants that your eye tends to gravitate toward. It's a beautifully composed shot.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. There's no question about that. So, I mean, John's looking around. He sees the quartet playing their music. You know, we saw that during the first week also when Takagi came out to talk to the troops, you know, and so we saw the quartet then also still playing their music. And then, you know, McLean takes the little bit of drink that he got from the waiter, takes a sip. You see him like wince. And then, you know, so does that mean that it spiked? Does that mean that he just wasn't expecting it to taste the way that it does? You know,
I'm going to guess being somebody from New York going to California, it was probably one of a drink that might be a little more of a frou-frou drink that he wouldn't be used to and was expecting expecting like a cranberry or maybe a wine or maybe even just an alcoholic beverage. But this probably has something like, I don't know, myrrh in it or something, or frankincense. I don't know. Just look what we're doing to be Christmassy. And he just goes, oh, and he just turns right around and says, I'm about done with that.
Yeah, completely. And then he looks around and he looks pretty bored. You know, he's like, okay, what am I doing here? This is not a place where I need to be.
Well, you know? And costume design also sets him apart. Not only does he's the only one who's not having a, quote, good time, but he doesn't look like he belongs there.
Right. Right. Which we'll get to tomorrow about that fact, you know. And, you know, he keeps walking around. We're not sure again what he's looking for. You know, maybe he's trying to find his wife or find someone who would know where she is or whatever it is. And then he bumps into a woman who turns around. You can see that she's Oriental, which later on, you know, once we get more into what this company is or whatever, it makes a little more sense. Because at first you don't really know why she's there, you know, how she's connected to things, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But in some ways it's foreshadowing. You know, we already know that the name of the company is Nakatomi. So maybe, you know, that you know, there are a lot of foreigners, you know, that have been brought in from the home base in Japan, you know, to work in this office.
Mm-hmm. You know? Oh, by the way, one other detail that just before we were talking about the drink that I did want to point out. Again, it's one of those storytelling things. He's still wearing his wedding ring.
Yes.
You see that prominently when he puts the drink. It makes me wonder, is the device of the drink really there to show he still is wearing his ring?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in Die Hard 2, he plays a little more with the ring in order to prove things, but here you're right. You can definitely see it. It's very true. And he actually, we hear him say to this woman that he bumps into, "Oh, I'm sorry." You know, he quickly says it, doesn't really say it very loud or anything like that, and then he turns around and bumps into this drunk guy who comes over to him, gives him a big hug and kisses him on the cheek and goes, "Hey, Merry Christmas." And John's response is, "Jesus, fuck, California." You know, which
Once again,
he like says under his breath.
beautiful detail matches my comment about, he expected maybe a typical drink and got some kind of a frou-frou weird tasting beverage. And then his next thing he runs into is a guy who's like, "Hey, Merry Christmas." He's like, "Jesus, California." Like, it's a comment on how he's dressed, Northeast, no nonsense, every man cop versus all these folks in business suits and business executives all living on the far West Coast.
Right. And I mean, he made the same comment in the airport when he saw the scantily clad girl jumping up and greeting her boyfriend. He also said California. So it goes
California.
along with that. You know, he's basically saying, all right, I'm not in Kansas anymore.
And I wonder, some of it is, and again, I think it comes through. This is a nice little subtlety. Almost wondering if it's like a very subtle judgment from McClane's character on life in California. He's very much conveying a sense of almost condescension or incredulous, almost like you can sense. He's using that as an argument. Why would you, Holly, want to live there? Have you seen how those people behave? Do you see what they do? I mean, total strangers, dude walked up and kissed me. Is this, come on, this isn't where you want to be, is it?
And that's not
So
something that
it's
would happen in New York. It's something that only can happen in California.
of course, the character is conveying that almost like the judgment of what it is to live in California versus where he's from, as if, once again, it's going to come down to, well, I'm right, you're wrong. You should be living with me in New York, not me living with you here.
Exactly. Now, I mean, this whole point that you just brought up reminds me of probably 30 years ago. I was in someone's house and I saw they had this poster on the wall that said the New Yorker's view of America, and it had like a map of the U.S. And you see like New York is humongous and California is humongous and Florida is humongous, and then you have like a little thing in the middle that says the rest of the country stuff. That thing, it's like there's the contrast between New York and L.A. Which are the two different, they're very different places for different types of people. Even though we're not
Absolutely.
going to get the politics, but they're all Democrats, both here and there.
Right, but culturally and because of weather, I mean, they are different. You've got sunny California where it's almost always nice breeze. New York goes through harsh winters. You've got it's a different lifestyle. You may have a huge city. They may both have arts. New York's more theater. LA is more film. They both consider themselves, areas of business and culture, fashion, but they are very different.
Yeah, that's true. And John continues walking, and he starts walking up steps. Again, it's very strange that here he's in the middle of this lobby and there are steps in the lobby, meaning that this floor is multi-layered also. There's
I was going to ask you a question. When we see in this room, obviously this is almost like a separate tier, but it's obviously two stories because we saw where the quartet's playing. We saw offices up above. Is up above the 31st floor, or is this a double story 30th floor?
I think that is the 31st floor. That's what I would think.
Okay.
I
Because
think
I
it's
didn't know if
that.
there were elevators that open up above the central area, or where do the other elevators go for the 31st floor based on the being a two-story building? I guess maybe off to the side. I've never thought about it before until now.
And there's also a few, you see a few groups of stairs. There's behind him, there's like a wooden staircase also. He's walking up, gradual stairs, I guess you can say. There's no guardrails or anything like that. He's just inside of this whole lobby area. There are large steps to walk up to get to either the next flight or the next half flight or something like that.
Yeah, almost like tiers. So there's multiple, which, by the way, would be very Japanese in the sense of having the sense of the different heights. You're not just designing left to right, but you're also designing up and down. So you've got a third dimension, how you lay out your feng shui kind of lifestyle.
Right. I wouldn't be surprised if they took that into consideration when they were trying to figure out how to make this whole set look, because again, mm-hmm. it is a Japanese company. So,
and that also explains the water, the waterfall, the greenery, yeah. very much reminiscent of what you would expect in a Japanese garden or backyard or decorating.
Right. And then John looks up and he sees this elderly man, he's probably in his 60s or whatever, you know, and he starts walking towards him. And then we can hear in the background that I couldn't agree with you more. And then why don't I talk to him right now? Which doesn't make any sense to us. You know, that he's having a conversation with a white-haired woman, which I'm assuming is his secretary or something like that, who's walking around carrying her pocketbook, which is a little strange to be doing at your own office at a party, unless she's mm-hmm. on her way out. You know, she's like, all right, I had enough. You know, Ellis just propositioned me. I'm on my way over to him. You know, who knows? And then we get to see that Takagi's eyes take in John in an interesting fashion. And Takagi is very comfortable here. He's got his hands in his pockets. You know, and that's pretty much how this minute ends, as the two of them are looking at one another. You know, star-crossed lovers, Takagi and McLean, you know.
Now, this actor, by the way, when I saw this movie, I was 18, well, almost 18. It was my senior year graduating high school, saw it in the theater. We talked about that yesterday. But I remembered him because my dad was an avid World War II movie watcher, and one of his all-time favorite World War II movies was Midway.
Midway, of
course. And I recognized James Shigeta, I think that's how you pronounce it, James Shigeta.
I thought it was Shigeta, but, Shigeta.
Potato, but I was like, oh my God, that's the Admiral from Midway.
Yes.
He played Nagumo.
That's right.
And I was like, oh my God. And to see him flawless, by the way, flawless English. We don't hear it in this minute, but we'll talk about it. And such a good actor, even though a lot of his stuff was television. Just a really good actor. He's just fun to watch.
Yeah. I brought up a little trivia thing about him. I think it was during the first week, where he's actually credited in a movie that just came out now in 2022. There is a Star Trek fan film that he took part in. He passed away in 2014. And there's a Star Trek fan film that finally got released. It was filmed mostly in the 80s. So he played an admiral in the Star Trek movie, which I thought was just really cool. The fact that it was finally released after so many years. He and George Takei were in the movie together. We're in the, I guess you can call it a movie. Yeah, it's a fan film. So yeah, that is a movie.
Yeah.
So you have anything else you want to say about before we get into the script?
No, I think we covered things. I was coming at it more cinematically and wanted to hit the thing about his ring and about his attitude, left coast versus right coast.
Yeah. I mean, this is a great minute to do that because all very those little things happens.
We talked about. Yeah, but I think all those things, again, subtly, I think too often movies, especially today, there's so much, let me tell you what you're supposed to get from this scene. Let me tell you. This movie, and John McTiernan said, I'm going to throw stuff in there that the audience will either pick up on or not. And if you do, you get a much more textual story and you feel how real these people are.
Yes.
And I love that. It's nice, subtle moments like that, but it adds to the realism of the characters.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. So the script, as every day I talk about the discrepancies between the final shooting script and what they actually give us in the final film. So first of all, there's a description as McLean gets out of the elevator. It says, McLean moves around the edge of the party, gradually spiraling inward. He grabs a glass of mimosa champagne punch from a passing tray, sips, scowls. Spotting open beers in an ice bucket, he tosses the punch into a potted plant, even burying the plastic glass. Sipping the beer, he moves through the dense party. People he doesn't know throw streamers over him. A woman kisses him. He grins. A man kisses him. McLean says to himself, shaking his head, California. Finally, he queries a dancing woman. The music drowns out their words, but she nods, points off in some generic direction. McLean heads that way, cuts across a Christmas tree, loses his bearing. He sees Takagi, who has an air of authority. McLean goes up to him. So, first of all, it's a great descriptive use of this entire minute. You know, it tells us so much. I mean, obviously, he just says California as opposed to saying Jesus fucking California, as he said earlier. I like the added touch with the beer, you know, because that goes back to what you're saying. If they would have shown that, that would show who he is. You know, he's a guy who doesn't need this, you know, champagne. He wants a beer. So What do you know about a mimosa cocktail?
I know that it's something my wife and girls love so much that we have, that's one of the things we look forward to whenever we have family gatherings to wake up that morning. Champagne and orange juice are your key components to a nice mimosa.
Right. Okay. So,
or it could be sparkling white wine if it's not true champagne.
Very true. So a mimosa cocktail is a drink composed of champagne or other sparkling wine and chilled citrus juice, usually orange juice. It's used quite often at brunches, weddings, in business meetings, or first-class service on trains or airplanes. Do you know when the National Mimosa Day is? There's an unofficial holiday known as National Mimosa Day.
We just had it not that long ago from when we were recording.
That is correct.
Yeah, it's sometime in May, and I can't remember the exact day.
But it was just May 16th. It was May 16th. Just, you know, we'll let people a little bit behind the curtain. It's about a week ago. So, yeah, that's very cool. Do you know why it's named mimosa?
It's named after the mimosa plant.
Right. It's a yellow plant known as the mimosa plant, which is the Acacia dilbata. I think that's what it's how it's pronounced, right? It's sometimes known as champagne orange. It became very popular in the U.S. only late in the 1960s when basically an article came out about the fact that the Queen Elizabeth was drinking a mimosa, and it took off from there. Many people think that it's a variation, or it is a variation, of the cocktail Buck's Fizz. I was able to find 9 different variations of mimosas that people make, okay? So you have what I just mentioned earlier, the Buck's Fizz, which was invented in 1921 in London, and it uses twice as much champagne as orange juice, okay?
Or how everybody in my family makes the mimosa.
So I guess you guys are not having mimosas, you're having Buck's Fizz, you know?
The big joke in our, I forgot what the meme or cartoon I think somebody shared, showed how to make a mimosa. And you take your glass of champagne, you grab your orange juice, and you tip to where a drop of orange juice goes in the champagne, and there you go.
Then you have the poinsettia, which is cranberry juice with champagne. And sometimes instead,
I wonder if that's what this is in this movie then, because it was a darkish red drink.
It's very popular. That we'll never know. We'll never be able to figure out what type of mimosa he was actually drinking here, because all it says is mimosa champagne punch. Okay. Sometimes in the poinsettia, they use vodka or Cointreau instead of champagne. Then you have the limosa. All right. There's the limosa. So what do you think that one is?
I have no idea. I've never heard of a limos.
Limosa. L-E-M.
Oh, lemon?
Yeah, there you go. Lemonade with champagne is a limosa. Then you have a vermosa.
Is that with main vermouth?
No, with apple cider. It was created in Vermont. That's why it's known as the vermosa. And all then right, you have apple cider that's mixed with champagne and brandy. That's called an apple crisp. Then you have the flirtini, which is pineapple juice, champagne, and vodka. Then you have the megamosa, which is...
It's all the drinks in one.
Yes, basically. It's a megadon. It's champagne and grapefruit juice. That doesn't sound very tasty to me. Yeah, it seems too bitter. That's what I would think. But who knows? I'm sure there are people who like it, so that's fine. Then you have the...
Obviously, if it's the name of a drink, then...
Yeah, that's true. Well, just because the name of a drink doesn't mean people like it.
Okay, odd.
You have the sherbet mimosa, which is champagne with a scoop of sherbet instead of orange juice. Huh? Sherbet mimosa. Then you have the lychee rose mimosa, which is... champagne with lychee and rose water. And then the final one that I found is a Hawaiian mimosa, which consists of rum, champagne, pineapple juice, orange juice, and cherry juice.
Mmm. That sounds awesome.
So there you go. Now you can go and make that for yourself. Now that you know how to do it.
It sounds like I'm at the beach or off the ocean.
Or in Hawaii. That many.
Yes. Right. Which would be beach and water. Right. We're both right.
Well, that's why it's called the Hawaiian mimosa. Come on. Come on, Alan.
Love it.
Right. So basically, the only difference in the novel at this point, you know, when John's character, who's known as Joe Leland, gets to the Claxon building, so he meets a girl who starts jabbering away at him and trying to pick him up. And then he tells her that he's looking for his daughter, Steffi Gennaro. And she points him in a certain direction, and he quickly gets lost. And, you know, looks over at where there are a bunch of executives walking around. So that's pretty much the only difference at this point. So every Tuesday, we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where my guest will be able to give a little story about an adventure or misadventure that they might have had that is somewhat holiday related. So why don't you give us a story, Alan?
All right, cool. Well, I will do this. For all of the parents out there that your kids drive you nuts, you've got the teenagers, or maybe you've got the from as young as the terrible twos, the horrible threes. If you can battle through as a parent and you can get your kids somewhat self-sufficient on their own, they don't come back. It's amazing how much fun you can have with them at the holidays. And one of the things that our family has built a tradition around, and this story relates to actually this past holiday season. I always do a treasure hunt for my girls, every single, as young as they were, to find, quote, one of their big or the big gift. They don't just get it under the tree. They've got to earn it. And so we send them on a national treasure kind of quest where they get a little clue. I purposely mock them up to look like old, maybe even sometimes burned or soiled or stained, as if they're like some really, really old parchment and clue that they have to then go on an adventure, and they have to either decode clues, unscramble riddles, or try to figure out where. And I've led them initially when they were young throughout the house until they could find where their final gift was hidden. They all had to work together. When they got a little older and could drive, they asked me to go as far away as moving all the clues to all around town. So they would literally drive around Cartersville and Bartow County for a couple of hours looking for these clues, until they discovered mimosas and said they don't want to drink and drive, which I don't either. And the clues all got put back around the house again. But this last Christmas, my one daughter and her boyfriend, they've had so much fun all the years. And I still do them. Even this last year, I did one for them. But while they were doing theirs, my daughter and her boyfriend came up with one for me and my wife, because we've never done it. And
oh, wow.
We've always been like, how much fun would this be to do our – how would we handle the clues? And so they did one for us, and I will just tell you, the coolest thing about how they approached it is not only did they have individual clues, but as you discovered each new clue, it was part of a map that you would have to put all of them together in a jigsaw puzzle to form the map to show a coordinate, and from that coordinate, you'd have to figure out where it was on the property. They literally buried a treasure box for us to dig up with our, quote, gift or prize. Whoa. It was really cool. So, you know, all those years of agonizing and saying to myself, do I really want to go through this again? Because it takes a lot of time and effort and planning to come up with new clues every year, new puzzles, new riddles. But to have them do it for us, I was like, I'm already looking forward to the next holiday gathering, because they said they want to do it again. And of course, we do too. We've been doing it as our tradition. So that's a story that I look forward to the Christmas holiday more for hanging out with them than anything else. And it was really a lot of fun.
Wow, that's great. That's really cool. It gives us all hope.
Yes, there is hope.
There is hope that teenagers will turn into normal people. There you go.
They can. Some of them can. Now, my youngest, I'm not so sure right now. She's still in college, but we're keeping our fingers, eyes, and toes crossed.
All right. Very cool. So you want to tell people once again how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, if you want to follow up on a show that we do very similar to this, at least for our first two seasons, it's called The Wilder Ride. based on movies of Gene Wilder. Me and my co-host Walt Murray, we did Young Frankenstein season one, 1 minute of the movie at a time. We followed up with Blazing Saddles. And then when this whole worldwide event went on, we found it was easier to shift to a weekly guest-driven program where we talked to a guest about who was in, we thought, a particularly fascinating field or career. And then we would add what we're watching, what we're reading, what we're listening to, some other funny segments, but all basically more of a talk show. Still a lot of fun and timely, because you can still learn a lot about those cool people by exploring. Just go visit thewilderride.com website or search for The Wilder Ride wherever you find your podcasts.
Cool. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher you might be using to listen to this show. Finding me is also very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, you can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!